The chief lesson to be learned with respect to the trial before Pilate is that one can never be neutral about Jesus. One always sides either for him or against him. So said scholar William Hendrickson in his commentary on the Gospel of John, and not thinking I could state it any better than that, I open this second of our three sermons on Jesus' trial before Pilate with those words. Our text is John 18:39 through 19:16, and the take-home message is one can never be neutral about Jesus. One always sides either for him or against him. That's how Hendrickson put it. Jesus put it this way: he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. Luke 11:23. There is no third option, no neutral ground, no mediating position, just the narrow gate or the wide, the sheep or the goats, light or darkness. The fact that the Word, who, John 1:1, with God was God, the fact that he, John 1:14, became flesh and dwelt among us, thrusts upon us a decision, a choice. A dilemma. Yes or no, true or false, accept or decline. Our author John, in his first epistle, phrased it this way, chapter 5, verse 10, he who does not believe God has made him a liar, because he has not believed the testimony God has given about his Son. Door number one, believe God. Door number two, call him a liar. There is no door number three. We could spend a long time considering the way Scripture presents this dilemma, but this morning we'll focus on the way a key player in the story experienced it. Pontius Pilate, Roman governor of Judea in the time of Jesus, to whom the religious authorities brought Jesus because, though they desperately wanted to kill him, they lacked the power to do so. They were a conquered people. And while their Roman masters permitted them, for the most part, to conduct their lives as they chose, the Romans reserved for themselves the ultimate power, the power of life and death. So the religious authorities had to get Pilate to pronounce the sentence. Only in that way could the power of Rome be brought to bear on Jesus. Only in that way could they attain what they so desperately wanted, to have him crucified. Last week, George Bradley spoke on John 18:28 through 38, and he talked about authority and reality, pressure and irony. He said that though on the surface Jesus was on trial before Pilate, more deeply, ironically, Pilate was on trial before Jesus. And this becomes clearer and clearer in our passage. To Jesus' declaration that he has come into the world to bear witness to the truth, and that everyone who is of the truth hears his voice, Pilate cynically replied, "What is truth?" He's a philosophical skeptic, a spiritual agnostic. The catchphrase from the old TV series The X-Files was, "The truth is out there." Pilate didn't think so, not in the ultimate sense. That was his opinion. But in addition to being a philosophical skeptic, Pontius Pilate, in his day job, was the Roman governor of Judea, which made him also the Supreme Court of Judea. He may not have known about the truth out there, the airy-fairy spiritual realm where Jesus said his kingdom was, but on the ground, in the harsh light of day, it was his job to proclaim the truth. He was both judge and jury in the trial, as he himself told Jesus, "I have power to crucify you and power to release you." The religious authorities brought Jesus to him seeking a verdict of guilty so he could be sentenced, so he could be crucified. That's their agenda. But you don't get to be a Roman governor without more than your share of street smarts. the idealists and the dreamers did not rise very high or last very long in the rough and tumble of Roman imperial rule. Pontius Pilate knew the score. He may not have known capital T, spiritual truth, but he knew small t, practical truth. He knew who was doing what to whom. Last week, George called our attention to irony. There is nothing more ironic than the Jewish religious establishment proclaiming Jesus an evildoer. And even a cynical Roman functionary had no trouble seeing straight through that. So, after breezily asking Jesus what is capital T truth, John 18:38, he declares to the religious authorities small t truth, the truth on the ground, I find no fault in him at all. No fault at all. Jesus is, Pilate says, completely innocent. Which brings us to our passage, beginning at verse 39 of John 18. But you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews? Then they all cried again, saying, Not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And they put on him a purple robe. Then they all said, Hail, King of the Jews! And they struck him with their hands. Pilate then went out again and said to them, Behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him. Then Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, Behold the man. Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify him! Crucify him! Pilate said to them, You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. The Jews answered him, We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God. Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went again into the praetorium and said to Jesus, Where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. And Pilate said to him, Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you? Jesus answered, You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. From then on, Pilate sought to release Jesus, but the Jews cried out, saying, If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover and about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, Behold your king. But they cried out, Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him! Pilate said to them, Shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, We have no king but Caesar. Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. John records three times Pilate's proclamation of Jesus' innocence. I find no fault in him. John 18:38, 19:4, and 19:6. Yet our passage concludes with Pilate delivering Jesus to them to be crucified. If, as he himself said repeatedly, there was no fault in him, why did Pontius Pilate pronounce him guilty and authorize his crucifixion? Because he learned the hard way, one can never be neutral about Jesus. One always sides either for him or against him. And though Pilate had done everything he reasonably could to side with Jesus, at the end of the day, the price was too steep, so he sided against him. Let's fill in the background. In general, Jews didn't like Romans, and Romans didn't like Jews. And in particular, the religious authorities did not like Pontius Pilate, and he did not like them. He'd been appointed governor in the year 26. Now, there's no small debate about the particular year in which Jesus was crucified, but it is certainly between 30 and 33 inclusive. I strongly favor the year 32. But in any event, the authorities and Pilate knew one another pretty well by then, and they did not like each other. But they also knew they were stuck with each other and had, in theory, a common goal, the peaceful and just administration of the province. However, this particular province being Judea, home of the Jews, their city, and their temple, peaceful and just administration was a razor's edge, because the Jews, with their faith in God and belief in his coming kingdom, were always more or less on the verge of rebellion. Remember John 6, feeding of the 5,000? Jesus withdrew and hid himself, verse 15, because the crowd was about to come and take him by force to make him king. They're thinking, he's the promised deliverer, time to rise up and throw off the Romans. Chapter 11, after the raising of Lazarus, the authorities held their council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation." That's John 11:48, and for contemporaries it was clear enough, but we may need to explicate the unstated implications. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, unstated implication, rise up and rebel, and the Romans will come, unstated implication, brutally suppress it, and take away both our place and nation. The threat of rebellion was the elephant forever in the room of Roman-occupied Judea, which is why Caiaphas went on to say, John 11, verse 50, "It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." Well, Pontius Pilate was, if anything, more aware of that threat than the Jewish leaders were. Jesus had certainly appeared on his radar in a general sense, and he probably thought of him as just the latest of the zealot leaders slash supposed messiahs who came and went with regularity on that scene. Sort of like teenage rock stars, you know. Last year it was that one, this year it's this one, next year it'll be another one. It was in that environment that the authorities brought Jesus to Pilate first thing in the morning, saying, "This guy needs to be crucified." Their initial charge is that he's leading a rebellion, has proclaimed himself king of the Jews. Just last Sunday, he arrived in town with the crowd shouting, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel." So they bring him to Pilate with an accusation that is a half-truth, which Pilate takes seriously, questioning Jesus directly, verse 33 of chapter 18, "Are you the King of the Jews?" But in the ensuing interchange, Pilate discerns the accusation is only a half-truth. Yes, he's a king, but some sort of otherworldly spiritual king, not a real threat. And it is important to realize that Pontius Pilate was genuinely drawn to Jesus, sympathetic with him. He did not have to be. He could have mailed this in. What's another dead Jew? You want him crucified? Fine. Next. But Pilate, for whatever reasons, and I'm inclined to think they were sincere, but for whatever reasons, took Jesus' side against the religious authorities and tried to walk a tightrope. It was the Feast of Passover, and there were 500,000 or more people in and around Jerusalem. That crowd was like a big herd of cattle, and the one thing Pontius Pilate did not want to do was start a stampede. Very volatile situation, could get out of hand real quick, so he couldn't just blow off the ruling council who wanted this guy crucified. He knows it's a setup, and he's discovered, probably to his surprise, that he does not want to crucify Jesus, so he's looking for a middle way. Can he appease the leadership without sacrificing Jesus? Did I mention it was Passover? Passover commemorates the Jews' deliverance from slavery in Egypt to remind them that the Roman emperor, like their God, delights to free the prisoners. The Roman governor pardoned a convicted criminal every Passover. Perhaps that would satisfy the leadership and free Jesus. Declare him guilty and pardon him. This is our verses 39 and 40. You have a custom that I should release someone to you at Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews? Then they all cried again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. The different Gospels give us different insights. Matthew informs us the authorities persuaded the crowd to call for Barabbas. Mark says they stirred them up to do so. And the ironies are thick on the ground, because though John simply identifies Barabbas as a robber, general term, pirate, highwayman, Mark and Luke more specifically tell us he'd committed murder in a rebellion. In other words, Barabbas was actually guilty of the crime Jesus was accused of. We were talking about the meaning of irony last week. There's a good example. Well, after this, to Pilate's surprising turn of events, he proceeds to plan B, which, though it may not seem so, is still part of his attempt to get Jesus off the hook. He has him scourged, torturously whipped. John 19:1-5. So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Then they said, hail, King of the Jews, and they struck him with their hands. Pilate then went out again and said to them, behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know I find no fault in him. Then Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, behold the man. Behold the man. Take a look. Think about it. Here's your king with his crown of thorns, beaten and bloody, scourged and mocked. Isn't that enough? Aren't you satisfied? But when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, crucify him! Crucify him! Pilate was appealing to one of the most elemental and powerful human responses, pity. It's what you feel when you see an animal in pain and do whatever it takes to stop it, up to and including killing the animal, putting it out of its misery, because to a healthy human, to a sane human, that pain is contagious. You can feel it, which is why you want it stopped. But when Pilate compels them to behold the tortured and humiliated Jesus, they do not want it stopped. They're enjoying it. They want more. They want him crucified. And so Pilate, probably for the first time, understands there is something very strange going on. Business as usual was crazy enough in the province of Judea. Crazy was like the baseline in Judea. But what's going on here is at a whole nother level. In response to a sight that would have moved hearts of stone to pity, they called for more. demanded crucifixion. With disgust, he retorts, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." He knows, as they do, that's not happening. They don't have the power. As he will remind Jesus, only he, Pontius Pilate, has the power to crucify and the power to release. But with the intensity ratcheting up, the truth is coming to the surface. It's not about politics. It's about religion. He's not a rebel. He's a blasphemer. Verse 7, the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Brief reminder here. In the context of first century Jerusalem, which is the first century Judaism, which is the context of the New Testament, the claim to be the Son of God was effectively the claim to be God. There's a lot of confusion and disinformation about this in our day and age, but at the time on the ground, there was no confusion at all, as our author John repeatedly makes clear, chapter 5, verse 18. Therefore, the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Chapter 10, verse 33. The Jews answered him, saying, "For a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God." As Jesus' claims fell on their unbelieving ears, they heard blasphemy, pure and simple. And the consequence was equally pure and simple. Leviticus 24:16, "Whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him, the stranger, as well as him who was born in the land. When he blasphemes the name of the Lord, he shall be put to death." You'll recall they've already tried to stone him twice. First, when he said, chapter 8, verse 58, "Before Abraham was, I am." Then again, chapter 10, verse 36, "Because he said he was the Son of God." The claim to be the King of the Jews could be construed as a capital offense under Roman law. But the claim to be the Son of God was certainly a capital offense under Jewish law. And that's why the situation is so convoluted. It wasn't blasphemy because he was and is the Son of God, but the authorities refuse to believe it and want him put to death for blasphemy, but they know that's not going to fly with Pilate, who's got to render the verdict, so they truss him up as a rebel leader. But Pilate sees straight through that, so they come clean and say, frankly, it's about blasphemy. He claims to be the Son of God. What's Pilate going to think about that? Verse 8, "Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid." Pilate was already on edge. Got that big Passover crowd he dare not upset. Moreover, Matthew tells us he'd heard from his wife in the trial, during the trial. She said not to harm Jesus because she'd had a dream about him last night. He's got more than enough reason to be nervous. But when he hears Jesus claim to be the Son of God, he's even more afraid. How come? As he had dismissively said to Jesus, he's no Jew. He had little knowledge of and even less concern for their one true God. He certainly didn't understand the claim in the Jewish context. That is, understand Jesus to be the incarnation of the one true God. Yet he was more afraid, not because he understood it in the Jewish context, but because he understood it in his own context, the Greco-Roman context, which was much more pluralistic. Not the Son of the God, but a Son of the gods. Divine human hybrids, demigods. Their world was full of them. Hercules, supposedly the son of the god Zeus, an immortal woman. Achilles, sired by a human father, and the sea nymph, Thetis. Romulus and Remus, mythical founders of Rome, twin sons of the god Mars by a human mother, etc., etc. The point being, we don't need to attribute to Pilate profound biblical insight on this matter to account for his fear. His routine pagan background was more than sufficient. He already knew there was something special going on. Hearing the real issue is about being a son of God, Pilate understood enough to know there was more to Jesus than met the eye. He withdraws with Jesus for another private audience, demanding to know where he is from. But Jesus does not reply. The upshot of that exchange is in the first line of verse 12. From then on, Pilate sought to release him. That is, until the next thing happened, which is the rest of verse 12, the Jews crying out, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." So we're back to the rebellion charge, but with a twist. This time the spotlight's not on Jesus. It's on Pilate. If he does not crucify Jesus for claiming to be the king of the Jews, that is, apparently, though not actually, rebelling against Rome, they'll send a delegation, file a complaint with the emperor. And that's what settles it, because Pontius Pilate was not willing to risk that. You see, it wasn't merely a matter of losing his job. It was quite probably a matter of losing his life. That is why Pontius Pilate sentenced Jesus of Nazareth to be crucified, even though he found no fault in him. As you can perhaps tell, I have a soft spot in my heart for Pilate, and that's because I know the backstory. When I initially framed this sermon, I'd envisioned devoting a fair amount of time to that backstory. There's colorful incidents and wonderfully poignant quotes from Roman historians. But as the sermon took shape, that allotment got smaller and smaller until it's become a couple of summary sentences, which are these. In essence, there was a purge going on at the time. The emperor Tiberius was, by that time, a crazy old man, and he was cleaning house with a vengeance. There had been a plot against him, and though Pilate had nothing to do with it, the last thing anybody wanted to do in those circumstances was catch the emperor's eye. And a complaint against the governor of the ever-troublesome province of Judea, because he'd refused to crucify a Jew who'd announced himself king, even though the provincial authorities begged him to, that'd be tough enough to explain in a stable, rational environment. With Tiberius on a rampage looking for people to make an example of, you do not want to go there. When Pilate realized those were the stakes, he delivered Jesus to them to be crucified. The chief lesson to be learned with respect to the trial before Pilate is that one can never be neutral about Jesus. One always sides either for him or against him. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at Peter's denial of Jesus, and I hoped by putting that in context to increase your sympathy for Peter. You read the bare facts, he's just a gutless coward. But when you understand the situation, you feel differently about it. Doesn't make denying Jesus right or courageous, but if you can see yourself in those circumstances, you're much less cavalier about judging him. You wonder how you would have done. Clear parallel with Pontius Pilate. These aren't cardboard cutouts, stock villains and weaklings automatically committing their sins. They're people, like you and me, dealing with the pressures and complexities of life. Now, they just happen to be dealing with those in the most important situation in history. That's why we're reading their story and paying attention to them. But by sympathizing with them, we can draw more valuable lessons. Sympathy does not mean viewing their failures as successes. It does mean the lessons we draw are more nuanced than might appear at first glance. Pontius Pilate initially sided with Jesus. He went an extra mile or two in his attempt to keep Jesus from crucifixion, but he wasn't all in. When it came to everything he had, up to and including his life, there he drew the line and retreated to what he imagined was neutral ground. Matthew tells us he symbolically washed his hands, declared himself innocent of Jesus' blood. Next week we'll see in John the proclamation he insisted hang on Jesus' cross over the objection of the religious authorities. Those were significant acts. They had their meaning, but they didn't change the fact that he had condemned an innocent man to be crucified. I hope by coloring in the details to help you see Pilate in a more sympathetic light, understand why he did what he did. His life was on the line, and he learned the hard way. One can never be neutral about Jesus. You're either for him or against him. So how about us? What difference does this make in our lives? That there is no neutral ground, only being with Jesus or against him. Well, frankly, in our situation here and now, the small t practical truth is our lives are not on the line. If you are not aware you should be, we have brothers and sisters all over the world whose lives are on the line. They don't have to wonder how Pilate's story or Peter's applies to them. They're in the situation, facing the ultimate test. And we should pray for them and practically support them. But we face the test in a less dramatic guise. The question is the same, which side are you on? But we answer it in more routine slices of life. Do people know which side you are on? Most of the people in our culture don't even know there's only two sides. The common delusion, the zeitgeist, is that there's all sorts of neutral ground from which you individually, preferentially, perhaps choose multiple sides. We've already cited Jesus in Luke 11:23, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. Here's the same stark truth in other words, Matthew 10:32-33. Whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. One can never be neutral about Jesus. One always either confesses him or denies him. Do the people in your life know which side you are on? Family, friends, at work, in school, do they know? I'm not talking about preaching, not about or just about proclaiming the truth. The real point is living it, living through the pressures and complexities of life. For Pilate, it took that stark particular form. The question confronts us day by day in different ways, maybe physically, maybe emotionally, maybe relationally, maybe economically. Are you on Jesus' side as you bear the cross he told us of? Do others know that? How? It's one thing to bravely face the lions in the arena with the crowd intently watching. Quite another to, with peace, love, and joy, bear a burden day after weary day. But we're always answering the same question, the one question. Which side are you on? With him or against him? There is no neutral ground. Let's pray. Lord, you blazed the trail, you led the way, you bore the suffering, submitted yourself to the crucifixion, and we know and believe the resurrection as well. Thank you for that. Lord, as we face the pressures and complexities, would you remind us, would you make it clear to us, and would you help us show that we are on your side. In your name, amen.